5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker. Spelt quicker, pronounced cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Today's podcast is a special.
Woo-hoo!
It's a conversation with Mark Billy Billingham, who is ex-SAS, ex-Special Forces.
You SBS, might... you mean?
No, Mark, he's SAS. I mean, we find out all about my mistakes with that during the interview. And you might know him from SAS Who Dares Wins. That's a program which I love. They just finished the celebrity version, which Wayne Bridge won. He was in the forces for years. He also used to train and go through. He was one of the selectors for the SAS. He also used to be a bodyguard to celebrities. We talk all about that as well. So he's worked with people like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, Sir Michael Caine, Jude Law, Hulk Hogan, Kate Moss, Russell Crowe, Tom Cruise, blah, 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 blah.
There's a great story, isn't there?
He tells some fascinating stories. We discuss all about training regimes and things in the forces and in the special forces. And as Mark alluded to a little bit earlier on, I find out the difference between the SAS and the SBS. I hope you enjoy it. This is Mark Billy Billingham. We know him as Billy.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Billy, welcome to my kitchen. Thank you for coming in today. With all my guests, I buy them a present. I understand you're a really good beer drinker, but I bought you red wine, expensive red wine. Can you drink red wine as well?
I can drink red wine, yes. Anything with alcohol in it is good for me.
How is your drinking culture? Because I imagine in the forces, it's quite a... I spoke to Jason Fox about this, which, you know, his name will probably come up quite a lot during this podcast, but he said obviously when you're on tour you can't drink, when you come off tour you make up for it.
Yeah, I mean, your military life is all about binging, and that one big thing we do is binge drinking. We sort of eat it hard, and any opportunity we do get, we take advantage of course.
Does that create problems afterwards? Because we're hearing a lot now with the forces about all the problems post actually being in the army or the whatever force you're in. It's when you leave, that's where the problems start, isn't it? Does that create problems as well?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you don't realise how sort of well you're protected and looked after in the army. Obviously, you do a pretty wild, adverse job. But then once you leave, we all become a little bit lost. You know, you're used to sort of travelling at 1,000 miles an hour, and then all of a sudden you step out into civvy street, and things are a lot slower and a lot, you know, different. And you take for granted what you had around you, you know, knowing where the doctors were, knowing where the dentists were, knowing you got your food. And all of a sudden, I mean, it took me ages just to understand how I had to register to go to the dentist. I thought I could just walk in and do as I would in the military. So it takes a lot of adjusting, and people find it hard, and it creates a lot of sort of unrest in family life, because you're not used to really living a family life. You spend so much time away, and the old absence makes the heart grow fonder sort of sketch. It does, but all of a sudden now you're living with somebody that you don't know as well as you thought you did, so it creates a lot of strain, and guys turn to drink heavily a lot. Yeah. You know, after, and again, I guess mixed in that is not just the lifestyle, it's just sort of what you've been doing operationally and what you've seen sort of all compounds.
I was listening to the radio today, actually, and they were discussing the fact that some of the soldiers and people who have been fighting are now being brought to trial for certain things. Yeah. And a guy phoned up and said, we don't know, as people in the military, exactly your point there. He said he sort of left on the Friday. On the Monday, he realised he was a civilian, had no idea of how to just be normal, because you've been so institutionalised in this, in the forces. And he said it's really hard, but I think it's getting better now, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of progress in place now. Prior to leaving the military, they try and put you through a bit of a program of making you understand things like I've just spoke about. You have to now register on the council, you have to do this, you have to do that. But when I left, I didn't get told anything. I literally stepped out. But there again, a little bit, that my transition out of the military into civil life was slightly different. But for people of my generation, when I did step out, was no, you didn't get any guidance at all or any sort of medical direction.
No.
I mean, so they never really looked at what, and the cracks have started to appear as soon as people get out.
One of my last questions to you was going to be about relationships, because it just seems to me it must be so hard to, obviously you just talked about relationships post coming out, but whilst you're actually in the forces, how hard is it to have a relationship?
You become very selfish, you know, because of the nature of the stuff that you do and the time you spend away, you almost become a single man and act that way in many, many ways. You just sort of try to put your family and everything behind you while you're doing what you're doing, and try not to think about it, because it just compounds the issues that you've already got in front of you, which some of them are pretty frigging, dangerous, of course. But so you kind of block your family out for most of your tours that you go away to a degree.
And it must be hard for any partner, for someone, especially if you're in the special forces, where you're told, I imagine, to keep everything secret, pretty much. And it must be quite hard for your partner to know that there's another life that that your husband or your boyfriend or something is leading away from you. And you can't really talk about it because there's stuff going on you don't really want to bring home with you.
Yeah, it is. It's really difficult. And sort of the stuff that we did special forces wise, our communications were absolutely tight. I mean, it's got better now, I believe. We couldn't, you'd probably get allowed to make a phone call once a month, or you could probably write a letter, but it took so long to get home, you're probably back by the time they got it. However, I think now the communication is a little bit better. But yeah, for the partners, it really is. Yeah. They're the ones who deserve a frigging medal for putting up with what we do. We're away. And you're in dangerous zones, and it ain't all guns and roses. It's frigging hard. It really is. You never know, and the scary thing in the back of your mind is there's a potential, good potential, you might not come back, and you've always got that hanging above you. For the partners, they really, they watch the news every night, and they're going through it, they really go through it.
But Jason said one of the hardest things about being, Jason Fox, when he was on, was saying actually the fact that you can now speak to each other all the time, because it used to be, you say a letter a week later. Now you can actually receive really bad news and then you have to go and, you're going to be involved in fighting, in contact with it 10 minutes later. It's like, it could be, but there's bad sides to it as well.
Yeah, absolutely there is. I don't know if that's, it depends what you're doing operationally. If it's a really sensitive operation, and I'm pretty sure it's a blanket on no communication.
Lockdown,
has to be.
Yeah.
For security reasons and for the mental issues that you could create within your sort of gang there, So I'm pretty, however, in general, like when you're on like a 6-month tour of Baghdad or wherever it may be, there are times when it's not full on fighting, it's not full on sort of danger, and you've got to have that social element to your life. So they do allow now the use of Skype and phone so you can see each other. And sometimes that can be a hard thing, And exactly like you call home to find that there's issues at home, you can't help but carry that round with you again. You go back to your room thinking, right, we're going to go out and do a mission tonight, but the wife's at home and so-and-so's ill and whatever.
Billy, I'm a single dad, right? And so sometimes when I speak to my kids via Skype or something, I kind of, it makes me miss them more, but they're only the other side of London. they're not the other side of the world or like a couple of oceans away, so as you say, it's great that you can see them, but also I think it could have some mental implications as well.
It really does. And the old cliche, no news is good news, and sometimes it really is. I remember one time, we weren't operational, I was out in the jungle in Brunei, communications are really bad once you're in the jungle, And then one night, and it was going dark, I get this call, come over the radio, from a Gurkha who doesn't speak the best English anyway, to tell me that my daughter's been in a car crash.
Oh, no.
And that's all he could tell me. So now you can imagine what's going through my head.
Oh, terrible.
So then we try. We can't get the helicopter in because they won't fly at night in the jungle. So I spent like the next 12 hours waiting for daylight in absolute panic, not knowing whether she's dead, how bad it was. I mean, it turned out, by the grace of God, it wasn't as bad as it could have been, thank God. But I mean, yeah, so...
Is that one of the worst 12 hours of your life?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Because you can just imagine, you know. Yeah. I just thought, oh my God, this is going to be horrendous.
So you're out on tour at the moment. An audience with you, traveling around the country. Is it nice, the fact that people are so interested in the military?
Yeah, it's overwhelming. It's really grown on me as well. How many people? It's quite funny because I talk about my life basically. And, you know, I tell the truth of all the things I've done right and done wrong and why I thought I did it, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm just fascinated by the crowd. It's everything from a 9-year-old to an 85-year-old. And they all come up to me at the end of it saying, well, it was the most inspiring talk I've ever had. And I ask, well, what's so inspiring about it? Like, you know, and the answers are varied. But to have such a diverse sort of group of people telling you the same thing, it's amazing. And a lot of it is about the military stuff that they've come to hear, but I tell them stuff that they obviously knew nothing about. Yeah. And then it switches the focus. So when I come out at the end to talk to people, you know, it's all about what they came to hear military stories, but then they actually, oh, wow, I didn't realize you did so much for charity and you did this and about your childhood. And so it's been really, really interesting.
You literally, though, are putting your life at risk. And I think that's what's so inspiring for the good of the country.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we're so interested about it, and especially when the special forces, who really do go to the nth degree to put themselves at risk for other people. I mean, it's kind of a, you know, it's a strange occupation. How did you get involved in it? Do you mind giving us a brief history of how you did it?
Yeah, I mean, I was right from the start. I was a naughty kid. I got introduced to the cadets, and for whatever reason it was, I gravitated towards discipline. Although I was a bad kid and I knew how to manipulate the system, and I did. But I knew from the age of 11, this is where my destiny is. I need to be in the military. And I continued with my sort of naughtiness and in and out of trouble all the way up to getting into the military. And I just loved it. And I always talk about my decision of why I went to the parachute regiment as opposed to the Marines, because I was a Marine cadet and it made natural transition to go to the Marines. I'd already worked it down at Limston, you know, and then it was just before the Falklands. I sat and spoke to all these guys who'd been to the Falklands, come back, and one guy had been shot twice, and he was a paratrooper, and I just listened to his story. And it's not because I want to be shot. I just thought, I'm kind of that rogue type person within the military. Yeah, that really suits me, and that's the reason I chose the parachute regiment, and it really suited me. I love the danger. I'm a total crisis manager. I was fortunate enough to, my career really, I hit the military at this stage where we're really on a war footing all the way along from the time really I joined to when I left. And it suited me. There's two types of soldier. There's the barrack room soldier and there's the field. I am definitely the field soldier.
What does the barrack room soldier mean?
He's the person who likes to sit down and plan and look nice in uniform and that sort of stuff and organise. I'm not that person at all. I'm the break glass in times of danger. And off you go. And I really am. That's how I sort of, my career went. It was always crisis management and things happening on the spur of the moment.
What do you mean you enjoy the danger though? What happens to you? What are you enjoying?
I just love a challenge. I just
really?
Think, yeah, I love the challenge of, can I do this?
Yeah.
The failure to do is probably going to lose your life. I mean, I don't look, I'm not reckless. Let me be very honest. Risk mitigation is something I'm pretty good at.
Yeah.
But if the odds are probably 51-49, I'm going for it.
Wow.
Which is a bit, you know, and I am not reckless. There's something in my heart tells me I can do this.
So did you thoroughly enjoy your time in the forces?
Oh my God, yeah.
Are you like a retired footballer now? Do you just look back and think, I wish I could be out there again?
I'll be very honest with you, Tim. The first year, I really craved it. I missed it. I thought, I couldn't settle down. You know, not just the camaraderie. Everybody says it's a camaraderie. It's not. it's a challenge of the unknown of what comes next. What, there's nothing really out on Civvy Street that you can compare to it. And the, you know, kicking in doors and, you know, sorting out naughty people and doing great things, which is what the regiment does. I just really craved it then. I think over a period of being hurt for, you know, sort of settled down a little bit, and, you know, I realised, actually, I've done my thing. I shouldn't ask for something more because I don't know what the result will be. You know, I've walked out of situations where I probably should never have walked out of. I might not be so lucky if I wanted to go back and do it again. So I really do now sit back and go, I had an amazing time and I cherish it and I look back at it and I learn a lot of lessons from it. And I do, you know, I admire the young kids that are now filling my boots and wish them all the best. Because
can you ever replace the buzz? Which there is a buzz, I assume.
There's an absolute buzz, yeah. I don't think so, not to the level that you get within the regiment, you know. And it's that concoction of fear, excitement, and the unknown. You know, you'd never get it at that level, to be honest.
Have you suffered PTSD since coming out?
I've never had PTSD, and I never believed in it. You know, because I looked around and I was eating, you know, PTSD, this, PTSD, that. You know, and I looked at, I thought, hang on a minute, I've probably been through 90% more than these people that seem to be having it. And I didn't understand it. Why? All of a sudden. But, and then one night I was out with a friend who I sort of considered being a mirror image of me. Great, you know, lived the life to the full, you know, loved the danger, loved the lifestyle. And he'd been in a very bad accident, in a plane crash, basically, behind enemy lines. And I was out with him one night, and he just broke down outside this club and grabbed me, and I didn't know how to handle it. He was crying in front of me. I was like, I just didn't know where. And I sat with him till early hours of the morning listening to him. And he then started to recite the crash, how he was, his kids, what he kept seeing, how he couldn't sleep. And then I realised it really is there. And it is there. And I then realised, you know, there's a lot more people suffering. I mean, I've had my dark moments, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But it's never really affected me to sort of have to change my lifestyle or have to, you know, seek help, to be honest. I think the darkest moments I really had was my mum and dad dying within 3 weeks of each other, and that just that kind of hurt me for a few months. And then a friend of mine committing suicide and having to stand there and read the eulogy affected me, but not long term. The other thing with PTSD is, unfortunately, you know, there are people out there that really need it, have got it and need help. There's just so many people just jump on the bandwagon. You know, if somebody doesn't get the internet for 3 days, all of a sudden they've got freaking PTSD. And it dilutes away from the people that really need the help and need the support. And it's a shame. Because
I think we're starting to understand mental health a bit better though now, aren't we? And I think it's been tough, and it's especially tough for anyone working in your industry or the police force or anything, because they're told to, you know, come on, you know what you were signing up for, strong, you know, step up a little and all that. But you don't know how you're going to feel when you come out, do you? And, you know, as you say, it's not affecting you, but some other people it affects. So,
well, we're all different, and you're absolutely right. Yeah. You know, and the thing I will say about it is people go, well, you signed up to that. You were trained for it. No one's trained.
No, you're
no
not
one's trained
for that.
To pick up your
you're
friggin' mate that's been
that.
Shot in the head or blown to pieces. Yeah. No one is. It's the most ridiculous statement ever.
And there's children involved.
Of course.
Which you know, it's hard, but that is the when as soon as you're engaging with the enemy, there will be children there.
Yeah, there's women and children, there's families, there's people who don't want to be there, who unfortunately, you know, collateral damage, as you want to call it, whatever you want to call it, it's unfair, it's wrong, you know, but it happens. But going back to that, I mean, as soon as you say children or animals, people go, whoo. Even soldiers do that. Whatever reason, it affects you more, and it does, and maybe rightly so. But so imagine what doctors go through every day, having to tell kids they've got cancer or tell their parents. So you know, the thing about PTSD, it's not just military; it's out there.
Sorry, go on. We just
So I mean, I do recognise it now, but we're all different.
Are children your kryptonite, do you think, as a soldier?
Yeah,
the bit where you're out there, which can. Because you obviously got to get in a zone when you're out there and in amongst it, and then the children thing must be hard.
It's horrendous, mate. It changes everything. The dynamic of everything. If you're about to, you know, you get your intelligence, you're going against some pretty badass people, which is generally what we're doing, and then all of a sudden you get onto target and intelligence ain't quite got it right, or they've missed, and there's kids or women, you're like, oh, it just throws the whole thing into chaos.
Yeah.
And it does. I mean, everybody, I don't care who you are, you just become a different beast when there's kids involved. You really, it changes everything. Yeah.
Now, help me out, because I got myself into trouble when I talked to Jason Fox, because I stupidly called him SAS at one stage. Silly me, rather than Special Forces. And he's SBS.
Yeah.
I thought when you... you might as well explain to me how it works, because I thought you all worked together. But do you... Are you? I thought you went into the forces, and then when you got chosen for the Special Forces, you ended up all working together. Is that not what happened?
No, we do. But we have different roles. So you've got the SAS and SBS. And it's only really over the last 15 years or so, it was while I was a director of staff on selection, that we all started doing the same selection. There's two special forces units in the British Army,
right.
SAS, SBS, a Special Air Service. We actually cover everything, air, land, you know, mountains, and over the water, under the water, over the mountains, over the desert, and, you know, we cover and fruit coming from the air. SBS is boat service. They predominantly specialise purely on the water and below the water. So that was their sort of... So if we had an incident that was out at sea, we'd generally call in the SBS to lead on it, although we had our own sort of troops that are both... Supposedly they're a little bit more specialist. However, over the years, they've now become very much the same as the SAS in terms of they now do mountain work, they know air troops type stuff, desert stuff. I will always say not to the degree that we do in the SAS. So that's the differences. We do work together. It's a big operation. I mean, the SAS generally pick up most of the stuff, but they'll always take an element of the SBS with them. So we do the same stuff. And people say to me, what's the difference between the SAS and the SBS? SAS, under SBS under the water, SAS we walk over the water.
My next question was, are you rivals?
We are rivals, but it's always great banter. It's almost like Parachute Regiment and Marines, you know, we're always at each other's throat, but when it comes to the crunch, we're all amalgamated and go together. Same as the SBS, you know, it's the same thing.
Do the SBS get a bit annoyed that the general collective term for Special Forces is SAS? Because you know more about the SAS than you do the SBS, don't you?
Yeah, that's because we're more active, and we have been for many, many years. We're more actively involved. We are, and that's a fact. And if they're very honest, they'll tell you that.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, now it's you know, we're more and more involved together. But for many, many years, most of the big operations was done by the SAS.
Whose training's harder?
It's the same. It's exactly the same. They do the same selection now. So, which again was SAS selection. So, yeah. Your dares wins.
You trained, didn't you? You used to be a trainer.
Yeah, I was a DS, directive staff. I was directive staff for the Parachute Regiment to start with, which was an amazing time to see, you know, young raw material, young recruits coming into the depot and turning out, you know, a polished, experienced soldier at the end of it. It was amazing. And then when I was on the SAS, once I joined the SAS, I was also an SASDS. So I was the window to what we were looking for to come into the regiment, which was amazing.
All right, okay. So we'll get back onto that, because that's the best bit. But you've obviously done SAS Who Dares Wins, the TV show.
Yeah.
And how Wayne Bridge won the celebrity one, I just was talking to you about it. How good was he?
He was, I'll be very honest. He was awesome from the word go. He, like all of them, had some sort of mental issues that were holding him back, you know, which we sort of pressed on to get into his head and sort of get his emotions out. But he was always positive, to be honest. He was super fit. He was a front runner from the word go. But what we liked about Wayne as well was he was very much a team player. He was never all about him. He was always there to help and hand to anybody else. But he was a very strong character and a well-deserved winner, to be honest.
That's the thing about your... I love watching your shows. But the thing about it, we're all carrying so much shit in our heads, aren't we? And it really... As soon as you start putting people under stress, physical stress like you do, you guys, it suddenly comes out, doesn't it? And then when you bring them in with their hoods on, do they all open up to you quickly?
Yeah, I'm amazed, to be honest, because... You know, we've all got, let's call it skeletons in our head. We've all got something we don't want to talk about. And it does amaze me that some of the stuff that comes out, you know, you think, phew. But what I will say about it is, you know, it's a real strength, a show of courage by these people to do that. And I think they've wanted to get it off the chest for so long.
Yeah.
And they really want somebody to force it out of them. And that's what we do.
Yeah.
Because what we're looking for is, we're not looking for some superhero. We're looking for the true character. We really want to know what, peel back the layers and find out what you're really about. And you can tell when something's in somebody's head, you're hiding something, you don't want to bring it out. And you see it on the show. And eventually it comes out. And I am surprised sometimes what stuff does come out, because we never know what's going to come out. We know nothing about these people generally.
What they're doing on the show is tough, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even for you guys, that some of the stuff they're doing, I mean, you obviously all can all do it because you've all been there, but it's tough. Mm-hmm. It looks tough, but it you know, tell us, it really is, isn't it, the stuff they're putting themselves through?
Yeah, it is. I mean, SAS selection in itself is the toughest thing I've ever done in my life, mentally and physically. What these guys are doing, all right, it's condensed into 9-10 days of filming, but it's full on.
Right.
And it really is. You know, I mean, it's not as tough as SAS selection in reality.
No, obviously, yeah.
Far from it. But it really is tough. The thing is, the hardest, one of the hardest things for them is the unknown. Hmm. They never know when they're going to be allowed to sleep, when they're going to be, you know, thrashed across the mountains, or they have no idea what's coming. So they're always sort of trying to preempt what's going to come, which again affects their mind, affects their rest. They're getting tireder and tireder every day. And yeah, we really punish them. We push them to the limits.
The women have been put in the last series. Yeah. They were great. Uh-huh. How now the British Army has said that the women can be in the special forces as well recently. Yeah. How long is it going to be before they're in?
I think it's going to be a long, long time off, I'll be very honest. However, there are some really tough women out there. I mean, what we've seen on the show, they've been amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Reality, the long term, and then sort of life in the squadrons. Right now, I can't really see it happening, to be honest.
Mm.
It may happen.
Why is that?
It's just that lifestyle and the stuff we have to go, the uncomfortableness and the male... Men are different, but chemically, we're all different, you know, we're all built different. And women, there's certain things women can do better than men can do. There's certain things men can do better than women can do. Living in a cyber squadron is just, it's horrendous. It's tough, you know. Could you imagine being, having a woman, and human nature, if you've got a woman there, we do, we become protective of her.
Mm.
I don't know why, but we do. It just happens. You can't help doing it.
Yeah.
You imagine, you know, a lot of the stuff we do is behind enemy lines. There's a good chance at some stage you're going to get killed or captured. A very good chance. You imagine having your patrol, the woman in the patrol, and the woman gets captured. The rest of the patrol gets away and we're all men. It would just... You just wouldn't be able to operate.
It's definitely a psychological battle.
It's the psychological battle is what I'm talking about, yes.
Physically, everything.
Physically,
yeah.
There's some frigging strong women. Yeah, very strong. Women are mentally stronger
mentally
as well.
Strong, yeah.
What I would say to you is, I've worked with women in the SAS. Mm. For certain tasks, and they are frigging amazing, better than men. So what I'm saying, some tasks women are deaf, and we couldn't do what they do. They are brilliant, really, and they don't get the credit for what they've done. They don't even get talked about. So I think there's a role for them, maybe not in a saber squadron, maybe a troop of women that can operate in certain theatres. There's definitely a role there for them. We're already doing it, but you know, it's.
Jason also made the point when he came on, because I asked him the similar sort of question, is that the women at home as well, your partners, your wives and stuff at home, maybe wouldn't like it either. So it throws another, it's not necessarily that way, but it might just throw another,
another issue.
Another
yeah.
issue into already a complex life, because it's suddenly you're dug into a hole for four days
with a woman.
Yeah.
And it happens all the time. And I remember the first time that, they're going to let Wrens, the females onto the ships in the Navy. Yeah, you know, everybody's going, well, we know what's going to happen here. There's going to be relationships formed. Mm. There's going to be this. And initially, for 6 months, obviously, they're being watched very closely to make sure. But after a period of time, you've got to settle down and get on with your job.
Yeah.
You can't start babysitting.
Yeah.
And of course, it happens. Then it does happen. Then all of a sudden, relationships are formed, you know, smashing up families back home and all sorts of problems. And I guess over a period of time, you know, it could happen if they got into the regiment. Maybe, I don't know.
I suppose it all settles eventually. I remember the first time I heard about women boxing, I was like, what? Yeah. This is mad. And then now I'm so used to it. I think people get used to stuff, doesn't it? Yeah. And eventually we'll get used to it.
Yeah, and eventually we will, yeah. And yeah.
It's just a new concept at the moment.
It's a total new concept, you know. I'm all for, you know, equality. Women should definitely do selection. Go for it. If they get through, fantastic. It's just... you'll probably get one in there. So one woman amongst, you know, 99% guys. That's difficult. Mm. It's going to be really difficult. You're never going to get the numbers, I don't believe, passing SCS selection like the guys would, you know, 50%, 50%. If you did, fantastic, but I couldn't see it.
All right, let's talk about SCS selection then. Yeah. Because you were, obviously you've been through it and you're responsible for putting people through it. How soon do you realise somebody can actually go through it? How quick can you spot it?
I'll tell you what, it's you can tell pretty early. The SAS selection is, phase one is what we call the Earls. It's a month of going over the mountains with a house on your back. And you start with about 280 guys. The truth is we don't even look at anybody at that stage.
All right.
We just make sure, you know, we man the checkpoints. I know what they're doing. Get on with it. There's no point because we know that 75% will be gone before the end of it. So it's pointless.
Hard is that then?
It's fucking hard.
It's
hard. Yeah. It's hard, mate. Yeah. It's. But having said that, I mean, I was fortunate enough. I'd just come from the depot. I came from a training job where I was going out with young recruits doing 10 miles a day with a house on my back anyway.
Yeah.
So I was pretty fit, but I did pick up an injury towards the end and that really made it even more difficult. It's hard because the distances get longer, the weight gets heavier, and you've also got the responsibility, you know, by about the second week, you're on your own. You're navigating as well. So it's not just a case of head down, follow somebody. You're not following anybody. You're following your compass. Mm. So you've got to concentrate. You've got to keep your mind active and you've got to get from A to B in a time. And that time is, if you're 1 second over that time,
is that it?
You get a red right. card basically, and you get two chances. If you have two red cards, you're off.
And how many times you're allowed to go back through the course?
You're allowed to come back twice.
Twice.
Unless you've had an injury. If you've been injured, then you're invited back. So it negates the fact that you've been on there. You can come back and do it again. And to be fair, if you got injured in the jungle, normally what the regiment does is, okay, just come back for the jungle phase. You've already proved yourself over the hills, you know, so... And to be honest, when you do the hills, the first phase, there's a massive element of luck because if you get injured... you ain't going to get through it. So going back to your question, you know, when can you really identify people who've probably got a good chance? Yeah. When they get to the jungle, that's when you really start to look at people.
Okay, so they do the hills first. And also, that's weather dependent, I suppose, as well, to make it harder. I mean, if it starts raining and snowing and stuff.
It doesn't matter. If you do it in the summer, you got the disadvantage of, you know, taking on a lot more water and dehydration because it's horrendous. Still gets dark at night, so you've still got to navigate through the dark.
Right.
In the winter, which like I did, is horrendous. You got the frost, the mist, the rain. It's horrible. But for me, I actually like that because it gave me the motivation to go even faster to keep warm.
Right.
But then you've got the disadvantage of visibility. Right. As long as you can navigate, which I could. So it was an advantage to me. I enjoyed it.
Okay.
So there's advantages and disadvantages to both times of the season of doing it.
And then you've got the jungle,
The jungle is horrendous. Fucking horrendous.
What do you do in the jungle?
You basically learn survival, how to soldier in the jungle. Navigation is probably the hardest thing you'll ever do in the jungle. There are no reference points. Everything is green. Everything is brown. It's you literally, from the minute you get off the helicopter, you count every single pace you take for the next 6 weeks. And if you get lost, you could spend days, weeks trying to find out where you are. You could literally walk 20 metres, turn round and everything looks different and go back a totally wrong direction.
What do you reckon's more dangerous to a soldier, nature or other humans when you're in the forces?
I would say it's probably 50-50. Right. It's a 50-50 rate. You know, if you're against humans that are trying to kill you, that's obviously dangerous. I was just talking about this the other day. I remember we were out in Zimbabwe and we had a guy stampled to death by elephants out in the bush.
Well, that's just happened this week.
It's happened again this week. I just saw it, yeah. But this shit happens, you know. And then, again, bitten by some horrendous sort of creature, snake or whatever it might be. And we have people injured and die. And and all the other stuff that you have to deal with. Nature can be pretty lethal.
So you taught that all about which snakes are all right, which spiders are all right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in the jungle, how long are you in the jungle for your training?
For the training, you're in there for 5 weeks. It doesn't sound a lot, but it actually is. That's day in, day out. Yeah. What you carry in that jungle on day one, you bring out with you.
Right.
Even your poop. When you're out fucking on patrols, you're pooping in bags, and that goes in your burger as well. You leave nothing behind. And it's hard, and you go into the jungle, and you take week by week. After the second week, it's day by day. After the third week, it's hour by hour. It literally is. And I remember at the end of it, I think there was seven of us finished. We started with about 280, I think, and then went to the jungle with about 45. By the final exercise, I think there was about seven of us left, or eight, and you're looking like a Belsen victim. Your stomach shrinks. You stink of piss because you're sweating all the time, the ammonia into your clothes. You're literally, it's really, really uncomfortable, but you just get on with it.
Is it hard to get calories on board?
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. Well, your food you're carrying with you, you're living off rations all the time anyway, so you're living on one particular diet, which is full of proteins and stuff, but you don't have an appetite to eat.
Right. Are you allowed to eat other stuff, like in the jungle, animals and stuff you catch?
You don't get time to catch anything. If you catch anything, there's certain plants you get taught about which you can eat, and you do. You take what you can.
Right.
You do, your stomach shrinks, and you lose a lot of weight.
Was there ever a chance you were going to give up?
No, I don't think so.
You're that mentality.
No, I just thought...
You won't give up.
I'll be very honest with you. Towards the end, I didn't care if I passed or failed. I just wanted to get to the end of it.
Right.
And there was no way I weren't going to get to the end of it unless they turned around to me and threw me off it, or I got injured or whatever.
So what's hardest the when you get to that sort of stage? Is it then physical or mental? Which one is, again...
Probably the mental side of it. Yeah. You've gone, your body's just kind of in autopilot. You're just going with what you can get. You know, you've gone from sprinting to fucking slogging along because that's everybody's doing the same.
Is it your job as the instructor instructor, if that's what you call it. Is it your job to try and pile even more pressure on these guys constantly to try and break them because you want the best?
I'll tell you, this is the difference between, this is the hardest thing about selection. We have a policy of no encouragement, no discouragement.
Right.
And what that means, you think about it, I mean, the most people in the military, and like I did with the parachute, you've always got somebody screaming and shouting you to get you to motivate you to get you moving.
Yeah.
In times when you're really on your chin strap and hanging out, somebody's there to motivate you, and it's not like, come on, scream, shout. In the SAS, you don't get none of that. You get told, okay, this is what you're going to do today. This is where you're going to go. So you never really have an idea of how you're doing and how the people are sort of judging you. It's all in your mind, and that's the hardest thing, is self-motivation.
Right.
When you're exhausted, it's so easy to go, actually, I can't be arsed no more. And that's what honestly, 90% of the people fall by the wayside because they've got the option to say, fuck it. And they do. It's exactly what, and don't get me wrong, I felt it myself. I thought, you hear the helicopter coming in and thinking, I can just call it a day. I've got my credibility. I've got to the jungle. No one's going to judge me. I could just get on the helicopter, go and have a hot shower, go and spend a week in Bali while I wait for the rest of it. So that's the hardest thing, honestly. And it really is, keeping yourself... Because the DS won't shout at you. It's not like you see on the show. There's no screaming shouting. None. The only time the screaming shout is when you're on the live range, he's firing just to get that momentum going and build a bit of realism. But there's no screaming to say, keep going, keep doing it. They'll tell you what you're doing, what they want you to do. And if you turn around and go, I ain't doing it, they go, okay, no problem. Go and wait over there, get on the helicopter, you're done. That's it. And it's quite funny because we've all got this thing in your head where how far you can go, and we don't know how far that is. Mm. All I kept saying to myself, there's no way I was going to give up. I felt like it. And you sat in the jungle school, and you can see everybody's thinking the same, God, this is hard, this is horrendous. And as soon as the first person puts his hand up, it's like the floodgates have opened.
Mm.
All the rest of them that have been doubting it, their arms go up, and then in one day, no one's moved for about a week, and you're all sort of hanging in there going, hoping somebody gives up. And then all of a sudden, 7, 8, 9, 10, just gone. They've all been thinking it, and likewise. But there's just something else, devil and the angel on your shoulder going, devil's going, ah.
When you're in the jungle, are you not always moving then? Or,
yeah, you are. You are, okay. You start off in a base camp where, because you're learning, you know, you'll, it's like, they call it the schoolhouse, the jungle schoolhouse, where you come each morning, you know, you get told what's happening that day, and then you come there for lectures and stuff. So the first couple of weeks, you're learning how to navigate, how to survive, how to soldier, how to attack, how to defend, how to do reconnaissance, etc. And then after the second week, you're then out. You're navigating through the jungle. You're doing all these skills that you've been taught and been tested on. Mm. Yeah. So.
And after the jungle, once you've if you've got through the jungle, is that it? You're in.
Oh no 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 no! You then go into interrogation.
Oh god.
Which is horrendous. It is absolutely horrifying.
That's why we find you so inspiring. Yeah, you put yourself through hell for this job. Yeah.
Mate, honestly, it's. You know, you have all these experts come and teach you proper survival, you know, how you can live off the land, how you can make a rope out of grass, you know, your Ray Mears, is all these people with all these, and then you get these experts come and talk to you about being in captivity, and then you get put on the run. You basically get stripped naked, put into this World War II clothing, like an out-of-work fucking violinist, and set off on the run, and there's dogs after you, there's helicopters after you, and you've got to, and you're navigating on a sketch map. You know, and people are out to get you. And if you get caught, you're on the run for 7 days. You know you're on the run for 7 days. You've got no food. You've got to live off the land, so you're starving as well. And then, you know, you've got to sort of evade capture. If you get caught at all on any phase of this, you're going into that interrogation for 12 hours. You get ragged. A lot worse than you see on the TV there. And then you're back on the run. So you could get caught every other day. So by the time you get to the final capture, where you're now going to get 36 solid of that, being put into stress positions, being dragged around and humiliated and questioned, and you've got to stick to this story. You know, you're totally exhausted. I mean, I was fortunate never to get captured until the very end, thank God. And then you do 36 hours solid. And it was the most horrendous thing I've done in my life. And I remember saying to myself, I don't care anymore. If we have to do this ever again, I'm fucking getting out. I'm not doing it. I ain't doing it.
What happens? They just put you... Is it just put you under stress and stuff?
The actual interrogation, but where they're screaming and shouting at you and asking fully and trying to... I like that. That was a break. It's just... You try. You just try, you know, standing... Just stand up straight with your arms in the air, right up straight, and hold that for 5 minutes. You just try that. Yeah. Jesus Christ, when you're absolutely, you know, you've had no food, you've been on the run, you've had no sleep, and then you kind of knees bent, leaning against, half against, it's absolutely horrendous. You know, I'd rather have a good kicking.
And when you're doing that, because you obviously had to do it, how hard is it to do that? You know, I suppose, that if you're not doing it, you're not getting the right people.
Yeah. Again, it's about the... Do you want this? Do I want... You cannot go and do SAS selection half-heartedly. If you go there thinking, maybe I want, I'm not really sure, you won't do it. You either want it or you don't want it. When you're lying there or standing there in those horrendous positions and your back's breaking, you're in absolute turmoil, you just got to keep saying to yourself, it's a passage in time, it's a passage in time, I will get there, I want this. And you have no idea what the time is.
So after interrogation, are you then in?
No. So you then get through interrogation and it's a pass or fail. It's as simple as that, you know. So let's just say you get through that. Then the next phase is you do, I think it's roughly about a month where you get taught counter-terrorism drills.
Right.
You know, where you're doing all the black kit going through windows, shooting over each other's shoulders. Yeah. There's always a chance you could fail that because you're not able to assimilate the information and react to it quick enough by this stage. You become a liability and dangerous, and they'll go, actually, you're really not cut out for it. So, unfortunately, although you got that far, you're not cut out for this sort of... And at this stage, there's nothing really special forces about what you're doing. This is just a selection process to see if you can fit in that SF world. It gets even more airy and dangerous once you get to the squadrons. You're really doing it for real, you know? Mm. And this is real, don't get me wrong. So that phase now, at the end of interrogation, is it's still you're being watched, and potentially I've seen people fail it. Mm. Yeah,
and then you're through.
Yeah, so that's now 6 months down the line.
Wow, and when you get through, you must have a celebration then with your...
You actually don't. I remember. In. I mean, you feel, you know, you like you pass out in the army, you have a big parade, and well done, this is amazing, you've achieved something. you literally sat down and go, hey, welcome to the regiment, there's your berry, you're going to D squadron, you're going to so-and-so, you're doing this, and then you're in.
And by the way, you're not allowed to tell anyone
that
you're in it.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's, I mean, you're saying that, yeah, it's, you're sworn to secrecy, right. You know. It's weird, you spend all your army career trying to get into the regiment and the rest of your fucking life denying it, which is bizarre, you know. But yeah.
What does the SAS, the military, the British forces, what do they think about the fact that it's become so, you lot have all become celebrities really recently? Do they like it?
No, they don't. I mean, even when I remember, you know, Bravo to Zero books coming out.
Yeah,
and I know
that's the big one.
I jumped on everybody's bandwagon. That's outrageous. How could you do this? How could you do that? I never read it. I don't actually read any military books because I know, you know, it always seems to me that it's always buffed up a little bit.
Mm.
You know, the scenarios that are real, just from the bits and pieces I've saw, I thought, well, that was heroic, but you're kind of over, you're Hollywoodizing stuff.
Yeah.
So I jumped on the bandwagon as well, and it is kind of looked down. I think it's been looked at better now, and people are starting to accept it, because we're in a different world now. Social media, everybody's accountable, and you can find out anything about anybody. So you're better off actually, without telling secrets and methods of operation, which we should never, ever do, put other people's lives in danger. I don't think there's anything wrong with talking about something that's already been in the domain, and actually, I think it kind of gives credibility to, as long as you're not a Walter Mitty talking bullshit and telling lies. I think it's not a bad thing. And I'm saying that because I'm doing it now. And it was really hard to make that transition of going, putting your head above the parapet and saying, no, I am SAS. But the thing for me was, when I left the military, I went into a very high profile job anyway. I was already, my head went above the parapet. You know, I was in every magazine and all this, and people
were
questioning.
Because you were bodyguard to the stars.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise.
Yeah, Tom Cruise, Angelina Jolie, Russell Crowe, you know, all these people, many, many more. But that was my job. You know, that was the job I chose. And so I was in every magazine. I never actually openly spoke and admitted that, yeah, I was SAS. But you could, the speculation, if you look in all the magazines, was Angie's new bodyguard, he's SAS, or he's MI5, or he's both, or he's Delta, is this. So people kind of knew roughly my background. And where the transition of me actually actively saying to people, yes, I was SAS. And I'll tell you the truth, where this happened again was when I was doing the bodyguard circuit. It's quite weird because everywhere I seemed to go, I met all these people that were all in the SAS, and not one of them could fucking spell it. And I was like, this is bizarre. All these people living these life that I've actually lived, and I'm trying to justify to my client why I should get the job, and I'm not really telling them I'm SAS.
Yeah.
But all these people, and I just thought, this is ridiculous. And it was. I mean, I met 10 bodyguards around the world that all SAS, and not one of them had even been in the army.
Right.
So I was meeting lots and lots of these people. So I thought, my name's out there and my head's above the parapet. So, you know, without not making it super public, but when I was like looking for work and working with clients, I went, yeah, I was in the SAS. And that felt really weird, because some people look at you, well, you couldn't have been in the SAS because you wouldn't say it. So I was in a no-win situation.
Yeah, a lot of those bodyguards were found out, weren't they? A lot of that, they've never done anything before.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
there was. But that was, living in that circuit of what I was doing, in that,
But yes, does the training of the SAS, does it work to be a bodyguard? Is it the same skills? I mean,
it's in many, many ways it is, because, you know, you're in. The thing about bodyguarding is people's perception is 6'6", V-shaped, big muscles, and can throw people around. Well, actually, it's none of that, you know. And that's, a lot of these bodyguards who are bodyguards believe that, and they're not fucking good at what they do.
Yeah.
Standing there looking.
So what is it? What do you need?
It's about your mind. It's about understanding the threat. Understanding what am I actually trying to do? I'm trying to protect somebody. Most of the thing I'm trying to protect is their image.
Is that why you took down Penelope Cruz that time?
Yeah.
You got to tell that story.
Well, no, that was a physical threat. Yeah, of course I will.
Quickly tell that story because it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, I was working with Tom Cruise, and I'd never met Tom before. I met him at the airport. I gave him a brief of what I wanted. And like everyone I worked with, they were very respectful. Your security, if you say no or say yes, this happens, I understand it. And I said to him, I may physically have to grab you. Got it, no problem. When I met him, I did the reconnaissance at the hotel where we were staying. There's about 200 people already there. And I thought, geez, how am I going to handle this? So I got hold of the paparazzi guys and goes, hey, here's a deal. You know he's coming, which they did. I said, well, I'll take him to another hotel unless you do what I ask you. And they went, well, what do you mean by that? I said, well, you leave us a big space to walk down to the foyer so we can get in. Don't create problems for us. And I'll stop him. You can get your photographs. They went, yeah, okay, deal. I didn't know how else to deal with this. So I pick him up, brief him up on what was going on. I says, there's 200 people at the hotel already. Please don't get out the car till I tell you. When I tell you to get out the car, stand to my left-hand side, stay close to me. If I have to grab it at any time, I have to. Got it. No problem. When I get to the hotel this time, there's 400 people at least. It's doubled. And I'm like, oh, shit. And so I get out the car. I'm like, and I had to spot the people I spoke to earlier. And I said, I warned you. But the deal is, I'm going to take him somewhere else now. And it was almost on command. They all stood left and right at the door, like the parting of the waves. I've never seen anything like it. And Tom looks at me and I look at him. And he's like, wow, what the has just happened? So I get him out of the car. And we've not even chatted about... All I knew about him at this stage was he's coming over to spend a weekend. He didn't tell me why. He said, I'm only here for a weekend. He was filming The Last Samurai and then I've got to fly back to New Zealand. I went, okay, great. This is what we're going to do. He said, I've got a number of meetings. I've got this. I've got that. Great. That's all I knew. We didn't have time to get the full details of who's meeting, what he's doing.
Yeah.
And so we get to the door, get to the hotel, 400 people now, but they all moved out of the way. So we started walking down the empty line towards the door, the rotating door, which I always freaking have difficulty dealing with anyway, and literally stop about 2 metres from it, turn around, they all get the photographs. Jobs are good, and we're happy, they're happy. He thinks I'm the bee's knees because this has all happened. I'm just about to walk in with him now into the door, and through the corner of my eye, I just saw something blue, the colour blue coming right at me, very close to me. No chance to turn around. So I grab Tom, and I went to grab him around the shoulders, I grabbed him around the head, and I grab this thing around the head and we literally go through the doors together into the rotating doors and through the other side. And as I've got them in front of me, these two heads, Tom looks at me, this thing looks at me and he goes, Billy, meet Penelope. And then we get into laugh and we're in the elevator and we're just laughing about it. He goes, well, at least I know I'm safe and the security's good.
She
had this big denim hat thing on. I had no idea.
Do you end up becoming friends with these people? Are you able to do that, or is that crossing a line?
Yeah, no, you do become friends, but you know, on a professional basis, you've got to keep a distance.
Right.
You have to know virtually everything about them.
Right.
You know, everything from the clothing size to their sort of worries to their medical record. You do.
And how much you got to be in the background? That's where I found some of the showbiz bodyguards are knobs, because they're in the foreground.
Yeah, this is where it went wrong for me.
Go on.
Because I was spending so much time with Brad and Angie,
right?
And if you read all the stories, I had a 12 man team. I didn't. It was me,
right?
Basically, and every now and again, ad hoc small teams around me. You couldn't trust people because I'm not vetting them. So I was getting seen with them so often. Everybody knew who I was. Like, for instance, when, by the time we got to New York, he was in every magazine, he was on every radio show, on every TV. So when they went to bed and I went off to do my reconnaissance, I turned up at a place, people go, oh, that's him. He's the bodyguard. So they knew. Mm. He kind of blew the cover. I was getting too close in terms of spending too much time with him instead of being at a distance. You're absolutely right. You know, I need to be in the background, not in the foreground. And that's what was happening. So the image side of it was getting blown all the time.
Okay.
I still was doing all the physical side of it. I knew how to deal with stuff. It was just, it became very difficult. And I actually said to myself, I'm too close to you now. I need to step back, bring somebody else in, and I can do the planning from a distance.
Mm.
And then on big events, so what? People know I'm there. I can be there. But the everyday living the life, I was living their life. Mm. I was literally living in their house. And I said to him, Brad, I need to move out. Even put an RV I had no private life either. Put the RV in the garden. I'll just live in that, and kind of debated that for a bit. Then I moved out to the hotel, and they didn't like it. They felt a little bit vulnerable, so it was really difficult. But you've got to.
Well, I spent a bit of time. Well, not I've spent time. On a few occasions, I've been around the princes, and their security's very much. You don't see them. They're very much
so it needs to be.
And then every now and then someone will get a camera out and come too close to the princes. And you just get these people and they're really polite, which is nice. And they just say, hey, no photos, thanks, like that. And they just do it politely like that. And it seems to work. It's not like there's no arrogance to it or like,
they just said, there's no need to be aggressive.
Can you leave the prince alone and not take pictures? And it's kind of seems to work that way. It seems to be good.
That's, I think going back to a stage back there about how you know, people perceive a bodyguard. Mm. 6'6", curly, yeah. Peter White hanging out, looking at suits, sun, shades on.
Well, if I'm
looking
there.
To take out the target, I'll look around the crowd and go, well, he's a bodyguard, he's a bodyguard. Right, you guys take him out, then I've got him.
Yeah, exactly.
If you don't know who these people
yeah,
are.
Yeah, yeah.
When we did a lot of the military sort of bodyguarding stuff and the commercial, that's exactly how we operated.
Yeah.
I'd have people in the crowds, people sat selling programs. They're their eyes and ears for me.
Okay.
And there'd be Billy, you know, down there is a little bit of a not too sure about it. So I'd go, okay, with my client, I'm changing direction, we're going over this way. And they wouldn't even question why. They knew I had them covered. And that's what I'm saying. It's all about the mind. It's all about knowledge. It's not about big arms and rolling around the floor. If I'm rolling around the floor with somebody,
yeah,
I'm not protecting the client.
How much is a life worth? If you're a bodyguard, obviously you're signing up to put your life in front of theirs.
Yeah, the old, would you take a bullet for somebody? No. If I'm taking a bullet for someone, I'm doing something wrong. I'll try and avoid that bullet by knowing the knowledge of there's somebody out there with a bullet. And you should be able to sort that out. You can look into a crowd, for an example. I do this all the time. As you're coming down the crowd, you can see everybody smiling, happy, smiling. They're happy that client's there,
right?
As an example. As soon as you see somebody stood in the crowd with a sour face, and I don't care who you are, when you're going to do something untoward, if I'm going to have a fight with you, and I'm not a bad fighter, I'd probably go, if I could maybe win this, I'll still be on edge. My actions, me realising it, I'm getting ready to come at you,
yeah.
And I'm getting a little bit twitchy. Now, I can stand back and go, that person there is acting not like the 70,000 people here, or 70 people here, all happy, and look, and there's that guy there, he's a bit twitchy, he's now looking around. You do actions you don't know you're going to do.
Mm.
And that's what you're looking for as a security guard.
All right, what about when you're going into, let's put you back in the forces, and I know you've gone to do things where you've sort of rescued hostages and things like that. That, again, you're putting your life at risk for other lives. It's not you going up again. You're actually going into a dangerous place. That life's worth a lot to us, yeah? Is that why we're getting them out? How do you equate that as a soldier?
Yeah, I mean, you're there to achieve a mission. The mission is to rescue that hostage. That's our role. That's what I'm getting paid to do. Now, don't get me wrong. You look at the whole thing and go, fuck, this is...
Yeah, but hostages usually have armed guards around them.
Yeah,
so
they
do. You know exactly.
And they did.
Yeah.
And we've still got to get them out. We've still got to do it. It's got to be done. And of course, you know, you're kind of in the hands of the gods. You've done as much risk mitigation as you can.
Mm.
You put as much in place to secure your safety, and then you've got to go for it. There's always an element of there's a good chance I might not come out, and I've had that on many occasions. And to this day, you know, I stand there and I go, how the hell did I don't know.
It's tough though, because you're valuing that life, that other person's life, to be bothered to do
it. But there's no other option. I always say in life there's an option, and there are options, and generally in a situation like that there is still options, but they're not particularly good options. But you've got to go with it and go, okay, how can I make this to the best of my advantage?
It's tough, though, because it's different. It's different to, right, there's the enemy, we're going to go and kill the enemy, to there's a life, I've got to get out from the enemy. It's a completely different mindset, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's where you look, you always go, the option that you go for is the element of surprise.
Right.
Having the upper hand, whether it's a split second or whether it's whatever it is, that's what you've got to find out and work with.
Mm.
And there's an element of luck, there's an element of skill, there's an element of, you know, like I say, planning and mitigation. You just have to go for it.
And how about
and I've been fortunate enough to get away with it.
Right. Talking about value of life. You, the one story I read about you is when you actually gave yourself up as bait for a sniper.
Mm.
IRA sniper, is that right?
Was,
in Ireland? Northern Ireland. That is a horrific thing to put yourself in position to. How do you equate that in your head?
Well, again, it's all about trust now. Yeah, I've got a bunch of comrades around you who, we've got a plan, we know what we're going to do, and you say to yourself, and I did on the cold light of day, is this important enough? And I put my hand on my mouth and say, yes, it is. Hopefully we get this right, because this person's already killed 13 people, innocent people. He needs to be stopped before he's killing anybody else. And I had the trust in the people around me to be able to react on the plan that we had to ensure that it wasn't me getting killed. And again, like everything else, on the day that this happened, was like it always does, you know, the key in any of this is communications, whether it's visual communications, which we didn't really have, verbal communications and technical communications. And as it does, as soon as I stepped into the danger zone, communications fucking went down.
No.
I had nothing. Yeah. So I'm now going on instinct. Do I go to ground and call this a day, or do I go for this and hope for the best? And it wasn't, again, being stupid about the decision. I just knew in my heart, this has got to be done. And I felt secure enough that this is going to happen, and it did. So, yeah.
Were you scared?
No, I wasn't. And that's not trying to be big and brave. No, I wasn't. I wasn't scared. I was, I don't know what the word is, kind of frustrated and angry.
Apprehensive.
Apprehensive, yeah, that's what it was. I would just fucking get this bloke. Let's get this sorted. He's got to be stopped. We've got to do this. So, yeah.
Are you enjoying your life at the moment?
Loving it. Just got married again. All my kids is, you know, coming together, and I've got a new life going ahead of me, which is totally reversed to what I've always had. You know, my head's above the parapet. I'm now doing this TV and talking very much in the public eye. But I'll tell you what I really love about it is it's given me a platform to people actually listen to me now more than they ever did before, you know, because of the social media and, you know, they follow my fitness, they follow my sort of ideas and the ways of trying to make things better. So, yeah, I'm enjoying it.
What is your fitness regime?
I try to do something every day. It's my fitness thing is my relaxation. If I can, each morning I get up, I always want to get up and train each morning. And if I can do that, it sets me up for the day. I don't mind getting pissed that night, doing whatever I do. I feel like I've justified it. If I don't train each day, I feel frustrated. I feel dirty inside. I feel,
So I have real problems because I keep on picking up injuries. And when I'm not training or doing any form of exercise, my mind goes. It's terrible.
Exactly that, mate. And it's not like some mad, you know, run a marathon every morning. I don't run anymore. I jog, but I enjoy it, you know. And I love training in nature. I'm not particularly a big fan of the gym, although I will use the gym if I have to, and it's great. I like being out in the fresh air, jogging, running, using the fences to do step-ups, pull-ups, whatever it is. I really enjoy it, and it's great. I'll train a couple of times a day if I get the opportunity.
How old are you now?
53, 54 in June.
Yeah. And what about eating? Are you careful with your diet? Are you all right?
I try to be. My missus, she's brilliant. She's right into the healthy eating, having enough vegetables, fruit, and always trying to stop me drinking. That's the hardest challenge in her life, trying to stop me drinking. I enjoy a drink. The problem at the moment is on this tour, while we're touring around, it's always fast food and junk and finishing late and not sleeping properly. You just have to ride that wave, you know. I guess very much to a military type life, it's binge living. Mm. We're binge fitness. Once I got a chance to train, if I've got a couple of weeks off, I'll go mental. I won't come out the gym. You know, I won't not train. I'm out there doing it. And then all of a sudden, I won't do anything for 2 weeks. I'll eat healthy. Then all of a sudden, I'm eating crap. I'm not sleeping. It's just that lifestyle you have to roll with.
If you're a young man or young woman listening to this now, would you recommend a career in the forces, in the military?
I still would. It's definitely different now. I think, you know, the safety precautions, if you like, are just sometimes a bit ridiculous. The health and safety, you can't do this anymore. You can't be realistic about what you're trying to do. It's harder. I think it's harder now. And we're more, all accountable.
Yeah, it's just more rules.
Yeah, and they're not always in favour.
Okay.
And they should be. You know, you're in a situation where you're making decisions that it's a split second, and no one will ever understand it unless you're actually there.
Does that affect morale on the people in there, that they're now going to have to be accountable, even though they're putting themselves under, you know, a situation where they could die?
We've always been accountable, and, you know, rightly so. Mm. And what people don't realise is, you know, you mess up in the military, you get punished probably 3 times.
Right.
You get punished by your unit, you know, whether that's thrown in jail for 7 days or physically punished and whatever it is. You then get done by the military police. You know, so you get fined, you get this, you get put into Colchester, and then you get done by the civilian police. Mm. And we are all accountable, and you should be. We're not above the law, that's for sure. It's just, when you look at the situation now, the soldier F's, it's just, I think it's disgusting that the government are not taking care of our guys. You know, we're not above the law. And they're not really, the government put people in us in these positions you know, and the government should be accountable to, you know, what's going on right now to deal with the families. And you know, it's awful that people have lost loved ones for whatever the situation is, but to use people as a scapegoat, and that's what's going on. It's become a culture of scapegoatism. It's disgusting.
Yeah. If you're a young man or a young woman, yeah, and you were getting into trouble at the moment, like you were,
yep,
a bit of a rascal character when you were growing up, uh-huh, is the discipline good in the military?
Yes, it is. It really is. It's not for everybody.
But did it help you?
It really did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. It kind of controlled me for a while.
Yeah.
And then I've always had respect anyway, but it teaches you more respect.
Yeah.
You really go back to old-fashioned values being in the military, you know, down to if you were on a bus and you're sat in the front seat of a bus and an old lady, you get up and, you know, you don't see that anymore. But yeah, the military people do that. You know, they respect their elders, they respect what people have done for us, they respect the people that have allowed us to have the life that we have today. And not just that, not just in a military perspective, in general life. Being more polite.
We're coming to the end of this interview, but the one thing that always amused me about when I interviewed Jason was when he started working in the civvy company, mm-hmm, and he realised people were lying in the company. And he says it in his book, and he said it was blowing his mind that people were lying, because in the forces, you can't afford, yeah, to have your, especially if you're in the special forces, you can't afford to have the person next to you tell a lie, because you could be dead. Yeah. And he's like, these people are lying. And he's like, welcome to the real world. Everyone's a bit of a knob here, do you know, yeah, what I mean? But did you find that at all when you came out?
You kind of realise, you know, there's a lot of bluffing goes on. There's a lot of bullshit,
yeah,
you know, and people spinning sort of, I don't know, whatever you call it, buzzwords to sound more convincing than they really, yeah, are, you know. I remember turning up at a meeting one time. I ended up in Kenya. Then I ended up at a conference,
yeah,
which I was told initially, oh, it was just a small meeting. I walked into this small meeting, which actually was a massive conference for all the oil and gas companies going back into Iraq. And I just listened to people, you know, in very high positions, just talking absolute bullshit.
Right,
I was like, that's crap, that's rubbish.
Yeah.
And then I got asked to do a presentation, which I was not prepared for. It was all about security.
Right.
So I bluffed my way to a degree.
Right.
Talking about security pre-deployment to Iraq, in Iraq, yeah, post. And I'd lived and breathed it anyway, so I knew it,
yeah,
but
yeah,
I wasn't prepared for it. Mm. And I just sort of rolled my cuffs down and rolled it out.
Mm.
And everybody's so easily convinced.
Mm.
But then I realised all these people around the table are all doing exactly the same. And it was like this weird, like you say, the consequences in the military is generally life and death. In civil streets, probably economically, you know, you're going to lose a lot of money, you may lose a task, you may lose a job, you may lose your job. You're not going to lose somebody's life. So you can't afford to be bullshitting in the military on the stuff we're doing. You are the eyes and ears, and the, you know, and if you are paying with somebody else's life.
I could talk to you all day, but we've come to the end of the interview. We've got a few questions we ask all our guests. Let me run through them with you. What one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
To take negativity, and this not to be cliche and bullshit, but to take negativity and not let it knock you backwards. You know, even when people in authority are telling you something that is, you can't do this, just believe in yourself and go for it. Just set yourself a goal of getting to where you want to be. And even if you don't get to that goal, at least go for it, and you'll definitely be in a better position than you were when you started. So believe in yourself and don't let negative people or, you know, things knock you back.
One of the best things I had was when I ended up on TV. A good friend of mine, Chris, years later came up and went, I've got to apologise to you. And he goes, and I said, why? And he goes, because I was the one who was going, you're such a knob saying you're going to be on TV. Look at Lovejoy, what a knob he is. And he said, and you've done it. And I sit and watch you every week. This one I was on Soccer Hour. I sit and watch you every week with my son, and we go, guy, he's great, isn't he? Like that. And he said, I have to admit, I've just slagged you off so much. Yeah. I thought it was brave of him to come up and say that.
It actually is. It's honest of him, and it's good.
There's nothing
actually wrong with that, you know. But when people who you kind of look up to, and you know, the CEO of the company saying, well, you're not going to go any further, you're not going to get promoted, and then you kind of go, well, actually, I'll prove you wrong.
Yeah.
And you go out, because it's easy to go, well, if he's saying that, fuck it.
Yeah.
I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah.
But you just got to go, you know, hang on, let me prove you wrong.
All right, what's it like being famous? This is an interesting question for you, because obviously you became celebrity in a couple of different ways, one for being a bodyguard, one for being on the in the SAS.
Two things I find really weird, somebody saying you're famous and you're a celebrity. And I actually had it at the petrol station earlier. I was filling up and this guy goes, oh, you're that famous guy. And I looked around and I was, who are you talking to? I don't see it as famous. Well known is probably what I like. You're now well known, you know, you're a figure. Yeah. Celebrities, like, it's a little bit glamorous for me. I don't like that.
Is it nice that we want to know about your life?
It's not. I'll tell you what is nice is the amount of positive sort of reaction I get to it.
Yeah.
You know, when people go, show respect. Oh, no, you look, and as they say, the bigger you get, the more people will have a knock at you for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a lot of that, to be honest, but it is nice. It's good, and I enjoy it, and, you know, I'll try and do the best.
Well,
I
think, as I keep saying, we're in awe of you because you're doing something that we wouldn't do. I can't imagine putting my life at risk. I'd be too scared. So that's why we're all in awe of what you do. What's the biggest mistake you've made?
Biggest mistake I made, like anybody in life, I made a lot of mistakes. If probably talking myself out of going to the regiment at an earlier age. I really regret it that. I always thought I was a bit too young and not really ready for it.
What clicked in your head then one day, thought, I've got to go in here and do this?
I got to the point where I was about to leave from one job to another job within the regiment, within the parachute regiment. And I thought, do I really want to start this all over again? Or is this my time now to go and prove to myself? And the two reasons I wanted to go to the SAS is one, all my mates had gone there. But two, I wanted to prove I could do it.
Mm.
And I left it, and when I was younger, 22, 23 year old, I thought, could I do this? And I kept talking myself out of it. That negativity, people go, oh, you're too young. And that's exactly what I'm talking about now. And I did. I went, maybe they're right. And I wasn't. Then when I got to the regiment, I got to the position of where I wanted to be, I realised we need younger people here.
Mm.
You need to come younger to have a fuller career.
Right.
You know, because I was 42, still going through walls and kicking doors, and I was a little bit tired, like, you know, where I could have been doing that 5 years before, which right. I wish I'd have done.
When you were the kid, though, young kid, and you first got into the military, what was the thing that made you want to go in the first place? I mean, if you're a bit of a tearaway, why?
Into the military?
Yeah, why did you think, I want to go in there?
I don't know, it was just something inside me said, this is for you, this is what you're going to, and I did, I was loving it, I was loving putting a uniform on, I was loving learning new things, you know, and challenges. I knew it was coming. Mm. And danger, I guess. Okay. And fear, the challenge of going to war or going into conflict. You know, Northern Ireland was massive at the time, and having the conversation with my dad, and he was like, really trying to talk me out of it. I went, no, I want to go. I want to prove myself.
Mm.
And I knew I wanted to do that. I knew the military was going to allow me to travel and do that.
Any life hacks?
This is a weird question. I don't really understand this question.
Right, things like little tips to help you do things, a packing tip or anything else. Or,
well, maybe I might go off at a tangent and be wrong, but it's like people talk about training, and I always say 70% of training is mental.
Right.
And I always swear by, whenever I'm training, no water, no food, no music. Train 40 minutes. And the reason being is, when your mind is going, oh, you know, when we're going to stop, your body starts to work harder. You burn off the fat quicker. And I might be wrong.
No,
it's always worked for me.
I like
it. It's almost the Rocky Balboa scenario of raw material, get on with it. And and my missus goes mental. She goes, I've got to have a cup of coffee and I want lower. No, there's no water, no food, no music. I want you to feel the pain in your mind. Feel the pain. When your body feels the pain, it works harder. It's fact. It really is. And you feel like you've really achieved something at the end of it. If I'm listening to Guns N' Roses, all of a sudden I've done 10 miles and I'm not really realised I've done it, which is great. You've still done it.
Yeah.
But when your mind is telling you, oh, my God, how much further have I got to go? How much further have I got to go? You really, and I'm looking at the hill in front of me.
Yeah.
I've really got to dig out blind now. And my saying is always a little further, and I really do say it.
I reckon that's why I quite like swimming, because you can't, I mean, I suppose you can now, but you don't tend to wear things in the water where you can listen to music. I'm sure there's inventions out there you can do, but I don't. I just swim and count as the lengths go on and on.
That's what I mean. And you think, but
you're feeling it because you just feel everything because you can't do anything else.
That's me. Yeah. And I feel that's when it. I train, that's it.
I've got to tell you, I've got twin daughters who are 17, and a couple of years ago, one of them said, "Will you take me for a run?" I went, "Yeah, all right." So let's go for a run. Let's try and get you a bit fitter. They were playing county netball and stuff. And I went, okay, so we were going to go for a run around the block, and we were going to go for a 2 mile run or something like that. And she went, "How do I carry my water?" And I'm like, "You can go 2 miles without drinking water." They're brainwashed children into believing that. Turn up for school everywhere you go. You've got to have water. Your body's fine.
If you go for a run with the kid today, I go, "Will we get internet on the way around?" I'm like, "Fucking internet! You think you're taking that phone with you?"
Can you recommend a book?
Mark Llewellyn's book that you've just got there. Yeah. I'm not trying to say this because it's Mark Llewellyn. It's the underdog. It's stuff we know.
Yeah,
but you just forget about. And I'll tell you what, it really is. I'll tell you, he sent it to me, and Mark's as mad as a fish. I love him to bits.
Right.
And I said, "Mark, I don't read books, I'll be honest." I said, "Send it in audio to me." And I went to walk the dog, and I thought, I'll have a listen to half a chapter while I'm walking the dog. And I swear, the dog, by the time I got home, I had to carry it. I walked it all the way through. It's just...
Oh, really? Okay, well, he's just giving it... By the way, Mark turned up with Billy, and that's why we've got the book. He said, "Oh, look, here, take my book." He's gone off now to somewhere. So, yeah. So I'm going to read that, and then hopefully... Shall I get him on the podcast? Is he good?
Yeah, he is, mate. He does what you do. I think he'd be brilliant.
Okay.
He is mad. He's a typical... I would say he's almost like an Einstein.
Oh, right, okay.
He just does the maddest of things, but he's a very, very smart guy. I mean, that is, honestly, it's just stuff that we know, but we need to be reminded of sometimes.
Achieving your dreams against the odds. I'll get him on and we'll have a chat. Okay, and the final question for you is, what is the meaning of life?
What is the meaning of life? I guess is to do the best, to make the world a better place, to do the right thing.
I suppose you've got to have that sort of mentality if you're in the forces, because you're in the military, because you are putting your life at risk for us. You've got to think you're doing the right thing. You can't think you're on the wrong side, can you?
No, not at all. You really have, and you've got to realise it's not a rehearsal. You've got to make the world a better place than it was when you were there. Give something back. Enjoy what you've got. You know, cancel the fucking invitation to a pity party every day and get on with life and enjoy it and you know, do the best and enjoy it.
You're still on tour all over the country. You go on all the way through to... what are you doing? You're doing a few now, and then you do September and...
Yeah, we're taking a bit of a break after this month, and then we've got a few in September, a few in November, I think, in October. And then we've now started booking up for next year, so we're going to roll on for probably another year.
If you go to markbillybillingham.com, all the dates are there, and the ability to book the tickets, so go there and you can see where all the dates are. They seem to be all over the country still, so you'll be able to get to one close to you, won't you? You're still doing the length of
it. Yeah, we are.
Thank you so much for coming on this podcast.
It's been
really
a pleasure, mate.
Really enjoyed your company. Thanks a lot.
Likewise.
Cheers, buddy. Thank you.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
That was Mark Billy Billingham. Thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. I learnt a lot.
Yes, you did, Tim. That was a bit of a schooling for you with your errors on SAS and SBS.
Yes.
I of course, knew all the difference.
Did you? Of course you did. I get all my terminology mixed up. And I think, again, during that interview, if you want to pick up on how badly I use my terminology with the forces, the military and everything else I use, I don't really know. I just know that they're doing a job that I couldn't possibly do. How did you feel when he explains all the jobs he does and all the training and stuff? I just think I'm so incapable of doing
it. There was one bit when he said, you might hear me laugh at, when he said, we're 5 weeks in the jungle, which, doesn't sound like a long time. He did that, does.
Yeah, it does sound
one
like
day
a long time.
More than plenty, thank you very much.
Yeah. Fascinating, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. It was brilliant, and I just enjoyed all of that, yeah.
Yeah. And again, I think he makes a point at the end, we do have to look after the people who are willing to go and put their life at risk. We do have to do that. It's really important that we treat those people well. And we give them all the support they need when they leave the forces. This podcast is sponsored by Quicker. Cooker.
Come on,
spell Quicker. Pronounced Quicker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Do you know, Mark, as I walk down the street, I keep on going down the street and people keep coming up to me and saying, "Tell me about your Quicker, spelt Quicker, pronounced Quicker. Tell me all about how the 100 degree boiling hot water comes out."
No, they don't.
No, they don't.
They should do.
They don't. They should do, but they don't. But what they do do is they tweet me constantly.
I've seen that.
They do tweet me, and they say things like, I've got myself a cooker, and it's really good, and things like that, because it is really good. It's a great thing. And then a lot of people are tweeting me saying cooker, spelt quicker, pronounced cooker. It seems to be a catchphrase. They don't seem to be using it enough.
It's up there, isn't it, with Paul Whitehouse's and Harry Enfield's catchphrases.
Well, I thought it was more like a Beans Means Heinz.
Oh, okay. So you mean slogan, apparently. Not catchphrase.
It's a slogan, yes. It is a slogan, which I went on their website the other day, and I see they haven't adopted it, which is strange.
No. And also, when you start up the website, it doesn't play my jingle.
Doesn't it?
So, I mean, I don't know. What's going on here?
I do think they should get slightly more into it, because I think it would work well for them. Cooker, spelt quicker, but pronounced cooker, is just the way they should sell it. Anyway, it is 100-degree boiling hot water straight from the tap. It does your hot water. It does your cold water. It does your boiling hot water to make your tea and do your veg and your rice and your pasta and your potatoes, your spuds and all that sort of stuff. And it also does filtered cold water too. Mark, if I wanted to get some beer this month sent to me, different sorts of beer, how do you think I should go about doing that?
I don't think anyone offers that. That's a crazy service.
It is.
Hang on. What's this? Beer52.com.
Oh, are they doing it?
They do. And if you go to, it says here, if you go to www. We're keeping that in. Beer52.com/Lovejoy. You can get a free case to try.
It's like
$5.95 postage. Okay. And you can cancel your subscription anytime you like.
Yeah.
But you get a free case of 8 beers, stouts, ales, porters, a snack and a magazine. Oh. Sent to your house for free, just pay the postage. And you, as I say, you can cancel the subscription anytime you like.
Yeah.
But they will then send you a monthly case of beer.
And they're all different beers, are they?
Yes, they are. And right. there's a monthly theme.
Yeah.
This month is Maine, as in the US state of Maine.
Amazing.
They're all from breweries in Maine,
yeah.
USA.
Yeah. Like many of the listeners, we're all thinking, was Beer 52 set up in the 1990s? Because Mark did the WWW bit at the top, which people haven't done for 20 years. It's like, when was this company set up?
If you put that in, nothing bad will happen.
All the W's, you have to say that. All the W's.
HTTP.
Did you say / or slash?
Slash.
Oh, cool.
Everyone knows how to do slash.
Everyone knows you don't do the www dots anymore. Mark, come on. You need to work on your...
Right, okay. That's the headline you're taking from that. A free case of beer for $5.95 postage. And you're going on about the bloody W's.
Yeah.
Well, there is actually no pleasing some people.
Any news on whether they've put any skull in for next week?
No, no skull.
Oh, for God's
sake. But what we have got is a Baxter Brewing Company Per Diem. And it's a pre-prohibition porter, craft brewed in Maine. We're looking at here. What we're looking at? We're looking at a. There's so much condensation on here. I can't see it. Anyway,
click do the can right by the speaker. So
I can't. I have to keep muting that because it's so loud.
Too loud. Okay. Oh, that sounds good. All right, we're going to try a bit of this.
So you'll like this because I've actually tried this. Here you go. Try that.
Oh, it's dark.
It's a porter, Tim.
Oh, that's nice. Oh, I really like that.
Yeah.
That's a really nice... Oh, that's a good...
So it's like a... It's the sort of main version of Guinness.
I went to a pub last night.
Go on.
And they had... This is something like 42 different beers or something and 20 odd different beers on tap or something. And what I noticed was a lot of them were very low percentage alcohol.
Yes.
That seems to be very much on trend at the moment.
I couldn't see on here what this one is.
This is not low at all. I can tell you the alcohol. What is it?
5.5. Mm. Yeah, that is quite high.
Yeah, so they're all... And there's some of them were knocking under 4%, which is really strange. And it was interesting seeing the different types of beer. And I thought there was a lot of choice there. And I wasn't sure whether having all that choice is a good thing. But what they're doing now is, and it's a nightmare because the pub was quite busy, is you can have a little taster before you actually buy them. So everyone's trying to taste everyone, you know, and it's just mental. They should probably have a, you're only allowed to try two, then you have to buy one.
Why have rules, Tim?
Because I was bored waiting for my beer.
It's like sometimes you seek out punishment and misery. Like we were talking about that thing without music. Billy was talking about running without music.
Oh, that's a good idea. And
you're like, why would you put yourself... You're like, I love this. I love this.
It's
like,
I do.
You can only taste two of the beers. Why do you want to surround yourself?
I agree with you about the beers. Okay, I'm wrong on that.
You're looking to punish yourself.
But I do not accept. I like the idea because I've realised that's one of the reasons why I like swimming so much is because when I don't have the ability to listen to music in the water and it's nice. It's boring. It's sort of slightly painful. It's kind of meditation.
Reminds me of a long time ago.
One turnaround, two.
This reminds me of a long time ago when one of your tips to make your life more miserable was to put stones in your shoes and walk around with
stones. That's good.
It's not good.
That is good.
That's rubbish.
Oh, that is good.
Well, I can't remember. It was
Have
a
you
long
tried
time
it?
Ago. No, of course.
All right, everyone listening to this, okay.
I now and again, when I go out for a run, there's a bit of cat litter in my shoe and I hurt so much.
All right, everyone. Do this, okay? Everyone listening to this, go. If you're wearing lace-up shoes, just pull them too tight now. So your shoe's really tight.
What for?
In 10 minutes' time, when you loosen them, it's going to feel great.
Oh, you're such an idiot.
It's going to feel so good. It's going to feel so good, and you'll go, that's a great tip.
But you're always looking for like...
Great tip. No, but it's not. Do you run listening to music?
I listen to podcasts.
Oh, you see, you're not even running then. I'm with Billy on this. I'm with Mark Billy Billingham. No music. In fairness, when I used to run, I used to always run with music. I haven't run for ages because my knees and my back and everything else. But I might start again. And if I do start again, because I've been doing some training to train myself back into running. One day on the podcast, I explained to you, but I'm training the style of running that I'm doing.
Right.
Someone's teaching me to run differently so I protect my knees.
Hang on, I'm just going to go and get you some sand to put in your beer so you don't quite enjoy it as much.
Well, you could do that. But no, it's not about not enjoying things. It's about spending the whole of your life, you know. Anyway, I like the idea of being just at one with nature running, and that's definitely the best way of doing it. Let us know what you think on that at Tim Lovejoy on Twitter or dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. I'm just looking up Maine here. Why is Maine well known so much for beer? Do we know?
I don't know, actually. That's a good... It says here there's more than 120 breweries and producers of beers in Maine.
Oh.
So that's quite impressive for one state, I would say.
Yeah. Brilliant. All right, that's it for this week's podcast. We will be back very shortly for the time being. Peace and love, Joy.
Bye.